True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
18-year-old Angie Dodge had just moved into her first apartment back in 1996 when her life was suddenly and violently snuffed out. In 1998, a young man named Christopher Tapp was convicted of Angie's murder. The prosecution's case relied on Chris's confession. The defense argued that the confession was coerced and that the state was ignoring DNA evidence from an unknown suspect. Angie's heartbroken mother, Carol Dodge, was left to wonder about this suspect that was still at large. After years of seeking the real truth, Carol Dodge watched Chris's confession tapes. Appalled by the interrogations, she reached out to an expert in false confessions, who in turn contacted the Innocence Project. But it would take several more years and the work of experts in DNA genealogy to find Angie's real killer and finally exonerate Chris Tapp. The use of genealogical familial searching and its success in this and other cases has really exciting implications for future criminal investigations. The public has shown approval for the technique overall. However, there really are some privacy concerns over the use of private genetic data to implicate a person or even his or her relatives in a crime. Join us at the quiet end for our discussion on the murder of Angie Dodge. By putting together a DNA profile and identifying relatives in the suspect's family tree, genealogist C.C. Moore and a DNA consulting firm called Parabon were able to find Angie's killer. Carol Dodge had really been crucial in the exoneration of her daughter's convicted killer, Chris Tapp, by casting a bright light on the failings of our criminal justice system. If not for her determination, Chris would still be an innocent man in prison, and Angie's real killer would still be walking free. So this is a really exciting case. It's one we've been keeping our eye on for years, actually. So I'm really excited to talk to you about it today, Dick.
Yeah, it's a very good case. So I needed an Idaho beer, and I picked one called the Dog Father from Laughing Dog Brewery in Ponderay, Idaho. This is an imperial stout, measures in at 11% ABV. So it's a deep black beer in color with a small mocha head, nice aroma, chocolate, brown sugar, coffee, and vanilla. Taste of dark chocolate, espresso, and molasses. Pretty filling in your mouth. You're not going to chug this, in other words.
No, it sounds like a delicious sipping beer on a chilly winter night.
That it is.
All right, so let's open some up.
We will. We'll split this bottle.
Okay, over here in the quiet end, I've got the dogs asleep, so it's a good time to record.
Well, we'll see how long they can sleep.
Well, right, and the worst that can happen while they're sleeping is there could be a little dog snoring, but should be pretty good. Let's get started.
Okay. Angie Ray Dodge was born December 21st, 1977, in Vancouver, Washington. She is the youngest of four children and was the only daughter of Carol and Jack Dodge. Angie was a gifted, intelligent girl, very enthusiastic. She really loved nature and outdoor activities. And camping was one of the favorite things that her family did together. And Angie became really resourceful at setting up the tent, finding water, and cooking over an open fire. And she really loved Christmas. Her birthday was just a few days before Christmas, and it was celebrated with a big combined family Christmas and birthday party. Angie loved the big family Christmas parties and gave gifts of her specially made Christmas necklaces. And the parties always included a program to celebrate the birth of Jesus, and Angie liked to play the part of Mother Mary.
Yeah, so really a wholesome family, although of course they weren't without their problems. But Angie and her cousin Alyssa would make playhouses under the staircase of the family's home, and then the two girls would play there for hours with their Cabbage Patch dolls. Alyssa wrote for the website AngieDodge.com that each doll had a special name and a little pacifier, and those dolls really seemed real to them as little girls. It was important to both of them that they took good care of these dolls by feeding, bathing, changing diapers, even scheduling naps, so they were way into this. Angie started out in preschool in San Diego, California, but then she attended elementary school, junior high, and high school in Idaho Falls. In high school, Angie tutored younger children in both math and English, and she graduated from Idaho Falls High School in 1995 with honors. Angie was a bigger girl. She was 6 feet tall. Plus, she was very gregarious and outspoken. So a person that was really hard to miss and a person who had a big group of friends. Angie's mom, Carol, has written about her last precious moments spent with her daughter on June 12th of 1996. Angie had stopped by the family home around 9:15 p.m. that evening and shared her excitement about, living in her own apartment. She's only 18, but she's very independent. While chatting with Angie, Carol reached out to give her a hug, and Carol remembers that Angie rested her head on her shoulder, and they rocked back and forth, almost as if they were dancing. Angie told her mom that she had done something stupid, but Carol didn't ask about it. The two had had an argument and a bit of a falling out just 3 weeks earlier, and Carol didn't want to pry or bring up any sore subjects. So Carol whispered to Angie that she would always be her baby and told her how much she loved her. Angie left her mom around 10:20 p.m. and returned to her new apartment. And Carol remembers her daughter pulling away, kind of in slow motion. She threw Carol a kiss and she whispered, "I love you." Neither mother or daughter knew, of course, that this would be their last moments together.
On the evening of June 12th, after visiting her mother, Angie had some unexpected guests. They arrived at her apartment around 11:30. These visitors told police that they believed Angie had been in bed when they showed up, but she still let them in to socialize. Now, these were three close female friends, and while they were chatting and visiting, they were in the living room, kitchen, or the outside porch, but not in her bedroom.
Which is significant to note. So it was Wednesday, June 13th, when Angie failed to show up for her 7 a.m. shift at the cosmetic supply distributor, Beauty for All Seasons. Two co-workers tried calling her, but she didn't answer her phone. And at about 11 a.m., the two co-workers went to Angie's apartment to check on her. They were getting worried. They found the front door to Angie's apartment ajar, and they entered. In Angie's upstairs apartment at 441 I Street in Idaho Falls, Idaho, they found Angie's body lying on her bedroom floor, semi-nude, bloodied, and still. So they called the police. After the police arrived at the apartment, they confirmed that Angie was dead, and this was from a knife attack. They learned that Angie had lived there for less than a month, and that she'd had friends visiting her until after midnight the night before, those girlfriends. And they last saw Angie standing on her front porch saying goodnight to them. There's an elderly landlady living downstairs, and she had not heard or seen anything during the night. Now, she also had some guests spending the night who heard nothing, and neither had any of the neighbors. So Angie's apartment was in an older home, and it had houses on either side, and houses across the street in front, and across an alley in the back. The backyard was fully fenced in, and it had a gate on either side. There was an unattached garage in the backyard, and it had an overhead door which opened out into the alley. The Idaho Falls Business District is just over 3 blocks south of the house, and the interstate highway can be accessed just 2 miles away. Angie's apartment had its own stairway and entrance that opened to the front porch. The stairwell entrance had a glass storm door and also a glass exterior door, which she kept locked. Inside of that exterior door, there was a light switch, and this controlled the front porch light and also the light above the stairs. And all of these lights were in working order, and the exterior door lock did work, and Angie was known to use it habitually. Now, at the top of the stairs, there's no door. The landing just opened into a hallway leading to the kitchen on the left and the bedroom and living room on the right. The one bathroom was located at the end of that hallway. The bedroom and bathroom doors didn't lock. There were large windows in the bedroom and the living room. The hallway, stairs, living room, and bedroom were all carpeted. There was no furniture besides a couple of small tables and an air mattress in the bedroom. She's the only person living there, and remember, she just moved in recently and doesn't have a lot of money to blow. But she did keep it tidy and clean, and there would be no signs of forced entry.
Angie's time of death was determined to be somewhere between 12:30 a.m. and 11 a.m. Investigators believed that the killer had entered her apartment through the exterior stairwell door, the door that was found ajar, or the killer could have climbed in the second-story kitchen door after climbing onto the roof. This door didn't swing shut on its own and was found ajar. Now, according to friends of Angie, she left the patio kitchen door open to allow air to circulate through the apartment.
Yeah, remember it's June, so it's hot.
Yep. And by her known routine, the exterior stairwell door was kept locked, while the kitchen patio upstairs door was often left open. That open door led to a deck, which could be easily accessed by climbing a few steps and climbing from the downstairs roof up to the deck.
Yeah, now if you think about climbing to a roof, it sounds like a lot of work, but if you look at this house, it's really quite simple. It's very low, it's easy to access. If Angie knew her killer, she may have let him in through the front stairwell door, but there was no evidence of a struggle outside of the bedroom where she'd been killed. So whether he was let in by Angie or if he surprised her by a sudden attack, this was just brutal. He had likely brought his own knife with him and took it with him when he left the scene. The killer probably exited the apartment by that exterior stairwell door, and that would be before daylight because that door was ajar. So this suggests that he didn't want to make noise by shutting the door completely, and he didn't want to be seen exiting from the front of the house. Like I said, this was a really warm summer night, so a lot of neighbors had their windows open, and the landlady living below was asleep down there with her two house guests. No one reported hearing any screams, so the killer had to have covered her mouth as he grabbed her from behind. At least that's what we think probably happened. Wounds on her hands, forearms, front torso, and neck really indicate that she was controlled by her killer, at least with his left arm, as he stabbed and slashed at her with his right hand. Now, this is horrible, but her attacker had ejaculated on Angie's body, and that's how he left DNA at the scene. He could have cut Angie's throat and ejaculated on her after she was dead, and a lot of the profilers believe that's the case, because it does seem that he did spend some time with her body after killing her.
Other than the immediate spot where Angie's body had been found, the house was not disturbed. There was a lamp, even on the bedside table, that was still standing upright and straight. So the experts looking into the case would determine that there is only one attacker and that Angie had been taken by surprise. She may have actually even been asleep when she was first struck on the head. Then she fell to the floor. Blood spatter was low on the wall, only about 2 feet high, which indicated that she had likely already been on the floor when she was stabbed and slashed. A comforter found on her bedroom floor had blood on it, but it was not collected or tested. Now, this failure of the Idaho Falls Police Department to collect that evidence and other evidence really showed that the investigators were already making some assumptions. So they assumed, first of all, that the blood belonged to Angie and no one else. But some of it, or a lot of it, could have come from the killer.
Well, I just think when you're doing an investigation like this, you can't assume anything. Especially in the beginning, you have to just save everything that could be evidence, because you don't know what happened, and you can't assume to know.
Right.
There would also be testimony about hundreds of photos being taken at that crime scene, and also at Angie's autopsy. But the defense was only given about a dozen photos. So that could possibly be seen as a Brady violation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the police began their investigation on the very day that Angie was found. But they didn't do a very thorough job canvassing the neighborhood. The first lead they actually had, and that was the one that led them to Christopher Tapp, happened when they learned that a friend of Christopher and Angie, named Benjamin Hobbs, had been arrested for a rape at knife point in Nevada. This seemed like a real lead. The perpetrator knew Angie, and he was already accused of raping a woman at knife point.
Sure. I mean, I think that's totally reasonable. But we have to remember, this wasn't until January. I think it was January 5th that he was arrested. And that's when the police started talking to friends of Ben. And that's when Christopher Tapp got pulled into this.
So there's already a few months that have elapsed.
Yeah, several.
Yeah.
So Chris Tapp, he was still young. He had dropped out of high school and he was really using a lot of pot, hanging out with a group of guys down by a river in town. Actually, he and Angie were part of this group of young people, locally called the River Rats, who hung out by the trails along the Snake River, and this was pretty close to Angie's apartment. Chris had also been seen with Angie at a get-together the night before she was killed, but a lot of people had. Two other guys who hung out with Chris and with Ben Hobbs were named Jeremy and Tom, and police were focusing on this group of guys after Ben Hobbs was arrested for the sexual assault. So Jeremy and Tom did go in to talk to police, but Tom and Jeremy's fathers both hired attorneys for them, and they stopped talking early on. Ben Hobbs had an attorney because he was already in trouble in Nevada, and he told him not to speak with the police anymore. So it was just Chris who was talking. His father kept bringing him back to the station for these long interrogations, and he didn't have a parent or a lawyer beside him. Like other people have made the mistake in the past, they thought, well, he's innocent, he hasn't done anything wrong, he doesn't have anything to hide, why not go talk to the police? Big mistake. Because, you know, if Chris didn't return to be interrogated repeatedly, there really would have been no case against him.
Yeah, but he kept going back.
He did, and he was trying to help.
Yeah.
Of course, he was young and naive. His mother seemed to have kind of a better view that this was not going well and he probably shouldn't be doing it. But Chris and his dad thought one of the interrogators they knew quite well, and Chris was innocent, so they really didn't see the harm in it. Although, after repeated interrogations, things did start to look pretty dark for Chris.
Well, they did. And then the guy, the policeman doing most of the interrogating, was telling him, you know, I'm going to take care of you. I'm looking out for you. You know, he was really luring him in.
He certainly was. A lot of manipulation.
So Chris's first interview by the police was on January 7th, and he was then released. He was re-interviewed on January 10th, and police scheduled another interview with him the following day. Before that third interview took place, his parents hired an attorney, and Chris didn't show up for the scheduled interview. The police went to his house, where his mother told him that her son would come to the station on January 13th with his attorney to answer questions. Rather than wait, the police returned with an arrest warrant and charged Chris with being an accessory to murder.
Yeah, so this was like on a Friday afternoon, and I think that's why they ended up getting an attorney out of the Yellow Pages. It always seems like bad things happen on the weekend when nothing's open.
Yeah,
I know anytime we have a dog who's sick, it's the weekend. But in the first interview, Chris had said neither he nor Ben Hobbs were involved in Angie's death and that he really knew nothing about it. Then at the next interview on January 10th, Chris said that Ben Hobbs had killed Angie and asked him to provide an alibi for him. On January 15th, his story changed again and he said that he had been with Hobbs when Hobbs killed Angie. He said Hobbs was angry at Angie for trying to break up his marriage. But we'll learn that all of these story changes were really being fed to Chris by the detectives. He was just trying to satisfy them and go home.
Yeah, most of the interviews were recorded, but Chris Tapp's attorney watched on a monitor from a separate room. He wasn't even in the same room.
That's so shitty.
Chris, like many people before him and after him, believed that since he was innocent, and he had nothing to hide, then talking to the police couldn't harm him.
Exactly.
Yeah, but boy, was he wrong.
Yeah.
Now, after at least 9 interrogations of Chris, his mother told him he wasn't going to talk to them anymore. And that's when the police got the warrant for his arrest. This was on a weekend. And as you said, Jill, Chris had found an attorney by looking through the yellow pages. But his attorney didn't do his due diligence. He kept allowing him to be questioned again and again without being present. And Chris kept talking and kept being manipulated by the detectives.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the Reed technique, because that's a really popular method of interrogation, and it was used by these investigators, but not correctly. There's training available in this technique all over the country, and there were a couple of the detectives interrogating Chris that seemed pretty familiar with the technique, but not familiar enough to use it the correct way. The tactics taught are not supposed to be used to talk a suspect into believing he committed a crime. Other objectionable uses in this case include threatening consequences, promising leniency in return for a confession, and conducting long, drawn-out interrogations. But that's exactly what was done with Chris Tapp. And just throughout January of 1997, Chris had been interrogated 9 times and for over 20 hours. Detectives just refused to accept his repeated denials to being involved. And when he refused to implicate Ben Hobbs, he was arrested and he was held in jail. When he finally implicated Hobbs, he would be released. So it's really obvious when watching the interrogation tapes that detectives weren't looking for new information. They were just working to wear down Chris until he would implicate Ben Hobbs. They had their sights set on Ben being the murderer. But when Hobbs was determined not to be responsible or not even present at the crime scene, their focus turned to getting Chris's confession. Never mind that the confession didn't match any of the evidence. They were willing to work with it and change it and make it what they needed it to be.
Sure, as long as they got that confession.
It really seems that way, Dick. I don't want to criticize the police. I know a lot of them do a great job, but here, there's some real problems.
Well, and that's going to get pointed out.
Yeah, but it just takes so long.
A very long time. So these were pretty grueling interrogations. Chris was convinced to implicate Ben Hobbs under the threat of prosecution. The urging of detectives, and with leading questions, Chris confessed to be involved in the murder, which he claimed was committed by Ben Hobbs. DNA from semen that had been collected at the crime scene did not match Hobbs, and it did not match Chris Tapp. But this didn't stop the investigators. They determined that 3 people had been involved in the crime. Because if we don't have Hobbs or Tapp's DNA there, there's got to be a 3rd person there, right?
This is just such flawed thinking.
Yeah. It really is.
It really is. I mean, normally, if the DNA doesn't match, that person's eliminated.
Right.
But not here.
Well, and they're not even looking at what is the most obvious thing. There's 1 set of DNA. There's 1 perpetrator. I don't know why you would think, well, we got these 2 guys, so there had to be a 3rd guy just because the DNA doesn't match. That's just a convoluted way of thinking.
Well, yes, and investigators from larger cities with more experience, as well as the FBI, would say that Chris Tapp doesn't even match the profile of the type of person who commits this kind of crime. Now, remember that Angie had some female friends who visited her on the night of June 12th, and she didn't take them into her bedroom. But then, according to Chris Tapp's confession, he showed up with 2 other men, and they were high, and it was 1 a.m., and she invited them in to talk with her in the bedroom? I don't think so.
Yeah, right?
So at first, Chris didn't think this was believable either. He at first said that the crime happened in the living room. But the detectives corrected him, and it took a long time. Finally, they got him to change the story to Angie inviting them into her bedroom to talk.
Yeah, with encouragement.
Well, that's a nice way to put it.
Now, one of the police involved in Chris's interrogations was the detective named Jared Furman. And this guy had a previous relationship with Chris. He had been the resource officer at Chris's junior high school. Now, during Chris's interrogation, Furman presented himself as Chris's friend. He told Chris that he would take the fall for the crimes alone if he didn't name Ben Hobbs as the killer.
Now, I don't know. Do you think they were well-intentioned? Because I don't know how this guy could sleep at night. He must have really believed it was true, is all I could think.
Well, everything we've watched pertaining to this case, yeah, Furman and the other detective, they are positive that this was a valid confession. They never stray from that story.
I know, but they change it. That's the thing. Under pressure and told what to say by the police, Chris told stories of Angie's murder that would change from one interrogation to the next. And as he really tried to create a story to please the police, they gave him an immunity agreement. If he told the truth, he would have immunity from prosecution, he was told. So Chris agreed to take a polygraph test, actually kind of excited because he thought, well, the truth of his innocence would come out because to him, this was a truth or lie machine. It was 100% valid in his mind. But you know, these interrogators used the polygraph to get him to confess to being involved in the crime. And it was so manipulative. The polygraph examiner would ask a question and then he would tell Chris what was true and what wasn't true, just encouraging him to change his story to match what they wanted. And Chris didn't understand, like a lot of people don't, that the police can lie to you. They were telling him a lot of untruths, and he thought, well, you know, if Furman's saying it, it must be true.
Yeah, and when the DNA didn't match that of Chris's friend Jeremy Sargis, Furman told Chris that he had lied to him about Jeremy being at Angie's apartment on the night she was killed. And boom, they revoked his immunity agreement, for what that was worth anyway. Bunch of spit. And after that, the interrogations continued. Chris was encouraged to implicate himself after that. The police tried to get him on the record, giving information to them, which only the killer would know.
Oh, and they just failed miserably with that.
Now, if Chris could have identified the house, the area where the assault happened, or the position of Angie's body, the police would have known that he was guilty. But he was wrong about all those facts. He thought the house was on a corner, but it was in the middle of the block. He said that Angie had been stabbed in her living room, but it was her bedroom. So what they ended up doing was taking Chris to the crime scene. They walked him through the crime scene, but did not record anything that was said to Chris or by Chris during this visit.
So that seems sneaky to me.
You're right. Chris had never been to the apartment before. They asked him to walk them through what had happened, but when his statements didn't match the evidence, they got angry and fed him the facts they wanted to hear. And this is when he implicated himself, although it was not recorded.
Yeah, so at first, there was no detectable reason for why the police accepted some versions of Chris's story, but rejected others. They really handpicked the statements that followed their theory of what had happened and totally disregarded everything else that Chris had told them. The detectives accepted as true anything that agreed with their theory and didn't let the facts get in the way of this.
Jill, hurry up. How are we going to be ready for the 5K if you keep stopping every couple blocks?
I can't help it. Every time I get in the zone and absorbed in a podcast, it's interrupted by advertisements. You know I don't like ads, so I have to stop and fast forward on my phone each time.
Okay, just don't stop in the middle of the street anymore. You're blocking traffic.
Well, my only consolation is that our True Crime Brewery listeners have an ad-free option. By going to our website, tigrabber.com, you can subscribe for bonus episodes, ad-free versions of our regular weekly shows, and a gift of TCB merch. Subscribing costs as little as $4 a month.
I know. It's a great deal. Makes an original gift for True Crime fans. But please, let's get back to our run. I've got a bottle of Curio waiting for me at home.
The tactics they used against Chris were really overwhelming to him, and he reached a breaking point and agreed that Ben Hobbs had told him to cut Angie's right breast or Hobbs would kill him too. So when he was told that there was overwhelming evidence against him, Chris didn't know that the police could legally lie to him, so he was believing everything. And this actually caused him not to trust his own memories of events. And the truth became whatever the police detectives told him it was. So the detectives told him his subconscious could be blocking his memories if he couldn't remember being at the crime. And this is heartbreaking because he really was just a kid. And you can see him saying, well, wouldn't I remember that, though? Well, not necessarily, they'd say. You could be blocking it. Which is outrageous. They're not even psychologists. But the focus of these detectives was really more on getting a conviction than on solving the crime, at least at this point.
Yeah, so normally, if a suspect's DNA does not match, then the suspect isn't prosecuted. But in Chris's case, they doubled down and insisted that Chris was involved without knowing who had left the DNA behind. And the police put together a version of events agreed upon with the prosecutor's office. And here's their story. The Idaho Falls Police Department laid out based on their own beliefs instead of real evidence. Benjamin Hobbs' wife had broken up with him recently at the urging of Angie Dodge. So this caused Hobbs to be angry with Angie. Then Chris Tapp, Ben Hobbs, and the unknown suspect arrived at Angie's apartment between 12:30 and 1:30 in the morning on June 13, 1996, with Hobbs' stated intent to talk to Angie about her involvement in his wife leaving him. At the time of this visit, all three of these guys were high on marijuana. Hobbs knocked on Angie's downstairs door. Angie answered it and invited them in. The four of them went into Angie's bedroom to talk. Now, the conversation started out okay, but it soon turned confrontational and became physical. Hobbs cold-cocked Angie, punching her in the face and knocking her onto her back. He punched her and he stabbed her. Hobbs then called for Chris to help him by holding down Angie as he and the unidentified suspect repeatedly raped and sexually assaulted her. Hobbs raped Angie, and the unidentified suspect raped her. Chris held her down during the attack. Then Hobbs forced Chris to mutilate Angie's body by slashing her breast with a knife so that he would share in culpability for the crime. And finally, Hobbs then cut Angie's throat, killing her. Then the three of them cleaned up the blood in the kitchen and left. They disposed of the knife and their bloody clothing at some unknown location.
So it's just not believable to me that if all this happened and Chris went to all these interrogations and knowing who he was as far as his age and his maturity and what he'd gone through, why wouldn't he tell them who the third person was? It doesn't seem likely that he would keep that a secret.
Well, no.
No, so he'd say he didn't know the guy's name, and then they would talk him into making up a guy's name, and it was just ridiculous. Chris went to trial for Angie's rape and murder in 1998, and he did hire a better attorney who was recommended by another inmate. This attorney, Booker, tried to get the confession thrown out, but the judge wouldn't throw it out. The jurors could not believe that someone would make a false confession like this, especially in a murder case. So there was absolutely no other evidence, but Chris was convicted just on the basis of this coerced confession, and also a little bit on the testimony of a woman who said she had overheard Chris talking about the murder at a party. But that woman would later tell Carol Dodge and also a local news person that she had lied on the stand because she'd been pressured by the police to do so.
Just one more example of the brilliance of this police department.
Yeah, but you know, Chris was eligible for the death penalty. At his sentencing hearing, he asked the judge to spare his life. Carol testified in favor of the death penalty. Chris was given life in prison plus 15 years. Carol was furious. She believed that he was one of Angie's killers, and she said that Chris deserved death. But she would definitely have a turnaround on that.
A 180.
Yeah. So prosecutors said they would continue to look for the other person involved in the murder, the man who had left his DNA at the crime scene. Carol was really concerned about this because if she's believing what the police tell her, and initially she was, there was a man out there, free, who had been involved in Angie's murder. And of course, this is a danger to the community as well as keeping Carol from getting justice for her daughter. So it was in 2001 when Chris recanted his confession and argued that he had been coerced by the police and fed information to put together this confession. His case was finally reviewed by the Idaho Innocence Project. A student and professor at Boise State University who were working with the project reviewed these interrogation tapes, and they concluded that Chris had been coerced into confessing. In fact, it was one of the worst cases of coercion they'd ever seen.
That wouldn't be a surprise. Of the cases we've done, particularly the ones that there was alleged or real coercion of the witness to get a confession, this is about the worst.
It really is, yeah. Then one day, Carol received a call from an inmate at the Texas prison where Chris Tapp had been transferred. This inmate asked her what she wanted done to Chris, as if, "We'll beat the hell out of him if you want," something like that.
Or kill him.
And Carol said she didn't want anything done to him. She just wanted the name of the guy who had been with him and had left his DNA at the scene. And there's no reason why we could think that he would be withholding that name if he knew it.
No. What's in it for him?
Right. So after that, Carol received a letter in the mail from Chris Tapp himself. Chris wrote that he didn't know who had killed her daughter. And Carol had been so convinced by the Idaho Falls Police Department that Chris was involved in Angie's murder that she'd never even considered that he might be innocent prior to this. But she decided to look into it. There were some hinky things, you know, especially him not mentioning the name of the third person. And why wasn't Ben Hobbs on trial then as well? So she requested copies of the interrogation tapes from the police, and she began watching them, playing them over and over, and taking notes. And she was pretty shocked. During the interviews, police already knew that Chris was not the source of the semen at the crime scene. And Carol watched as they pushed him to name an accomplice, and even promised him leniency, which we said is a no-no, if he was to name someone. And again, Chris said he wasn't at the scene of the crime. They fed him two names, and then he agreed that they were there. Then, when the DNA didn't match those guys, Chris said it was someone named Mike. This was disturbing to Carol because it really seemed like Chris was just making up a name to get Furman to stop interrogating him and pressuring him.
And a case review was done by the nonprofit group Judges for Justice in 2014. This was after Carol Dodge had contacted the Idaho Innocence Project with her concerns. And after 8 months of investigating all of the evidence, Judges for Justice decided that neither Chris nor Ben Hobbs had had anything to do with Angie's murder.
Yeah, so based on the information they reviewed, they determined that the Idaho Falls PD investigation into Angie Dodge's murder was begun immediately, and the detectives were working hard. It was a genuine effort. The first weeks of the investigation seemed pretty appropriate. They did take DNA blood samples from at least 30 men in Idaho Falls. But then in January of 1997, after the arrest of Ben Hobbs for that unrelated rape in Ely, Nevada, the investigation just really went off course.
Yeah, the Idaho Falls detectives decided that the circumstances of Ben Hobbs' crime in Nevada was so similar to the M.O. in Angie's murder that this itself was evidence of Hobbs' involvement in Angie's murder. That's maybe erroneous thinking right there.
Well, it totally is. It's similar, but he didn't kill this other woman.
This conclusion and the reaction to it set the police department on track to fit the evidence to their theory rather than putting together evidence to construct a theory.
And that's kind of at the heart of the whole problem right there.
Yeah, they know how they want it to turn out. They just have to figure out a way to get it to turn out that way.
Exactly. So they're not following the evidence. They're kind of creating the evidence that matches what they think happened. And the detective's incorrect conclusion is believed to have clouded their judgment and guided their priorities in the investigation into this tunnel vision stemming from what they call confirmation bias.
Confirmation bias is subconscious prejudice in favor of a conclusion that they had already reached. So the bias rejects any evidence inconsistent with the pre-decided conclusion and accepts anything consistent with it. So the more emotionally invested the person is in the case, the stronger is the bias.
And I think they were very emotionally invested. There weren't a lot of murders there. And Carol was at the police station constantly.
Absolutely.
And of course they felt for her. Who wouldn't?
It would certainly strike more at home if you're in small town Idaho and there's not, like you said, a lot of murders in that place, that when there is one, they're really into it.
Yeah, so the detectives may very well have been well-meaning, but really emotional detachment is crucial, especially in cases like this.
Absolutely.
I mean, as we know, in all aspects of our lives, emotion can influence judgment. That's why family members of a victim or a suspect aren't allowed to be on the jury, because there's bias. Psychological studies have shown that the number one reason for a person making errors in judgment is confirmation bias. So it's really an interesting thing to read about if you're interested.
So after the interview with Chris Tapp in January of 1997, the Idaho Falls Police Department investigation went forward under the preconceived conclusion that Ben Hobbs had killed Angie. Detective Furman convinced Chris that Ben Hobbs was guilty by saying they had evidence against Hobbs and also that Hobbs was implicating Chris in the murder.
So that's extremely manipulative.
Isn't it?
And I guess it's a tool that probably has worked in cases where the suspect is guilty. But in that case, you have to watch out for the confirmation bias and be focused on following that evidence. Furman's belief in Ben Hobbs' guilt was really strong despite having no evidence, other than that unrelated rape in Nevada. There really was no motive for Ben Hobbs to kill Angie or even to be angry with her. There's no evidence that Angie had anything to do with his wife leaving him and moving away to Utah. There was quite a bit of evidence, however, that Angie and Ben were good friends and that Angie had actually consoled him after that breakup. So that motive had been created by the police to fit into their theory. In his first interrogation, Chris repeatedly said that Angie and Ben were friends. Ben's estranged wife, her name is Deanne Calloway, told Detective Furman that Angie had nothing to do with the breakup of her and Ben. But he wasn't going to let it go because it worked with his theory.
Right.
So he clung to that motive for the murder.
Yeah, so the case moved forward with no evidence of Chris's guilt and plenty of evidence that it wasn't him. When evidence or witness testimony contradicted Furman's theory, it got disregarded. The scene described by Chris in his confession conflicted with the physical evidence, autopsy results, forensic science, psychology, and basic logic. So there. The repeated polygraphs of Chris were not accurate or valid. And on January 10, 1997, Detective Finn, the polygraph examiner, threatened Chris with a gas chamber. He also lied to Chris, which again, that's legal, about whether the test showed deception or not.
Right. So just leading him down this bad path and having him question his own memory. Because if the machine says he's deceptive, then he must be remembering it wrong. So he's putting all his faith in the machine above his own memory. So based on all of the available evidence, the judges for justice concluded that neither Chris Tapp nor Ben Hobbs were involved in Angie's murder at all. The crime was determined to have been committed by a male meeting the characteristics of a disorganized killer who lived in the proximity to Angie at the time of her murder. So let's go over the disorganized killer profile because I'm not really familiar with it and a lot of people probably aren't. Angie's crime scene was consistent with what is known as a disorganized crime scene. And the Idaho Falls Police Department detectives disregarded reports from a special agent named Les Stimson of the Idaho State Police and a Lieutenant Morgan Hendricks of Bonneville County Sheriff's Department, which both offered some insight into the profile. This is really a crucial mistake because the insights came from FBI profilers who see more sexual homicides in 1 week than the Idaho Falls Police would see in their entire careers. So I would turn to them. if I were an Idaho Falls Police Department detective. You think you'd want to talk to the experts?
Well, yeah. If you're seeing something that's rare, you could use the help.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's an ego thing or if it's just the tunnel vision. Maybe both.
Probably both.
So the disorganized sexual killer's characteristics are socially inadequate, unmarried, lives alone or with a parent, lives close to the crime scene, is sexually incompetent, and is below average intelligence and low in the birth order in their family. As far as the crime scene goes, a disorganized crime scene is one where the crime is committed suddenly, without a set plan. The offender uses what they call a blitz-style attack, approaching the victim from behind or even while she's asleep. So there's very minimal verbal interaction, and the victim is killed quickly. Masturbation and mutilation are done after death. Also, there's no attempt to clean the scene or hide the body. We know that Angie was left exposed on her floor, and her killer had left semen on her body in the area of her upper thigh and on the waistband of her sweatpants. So the position of her sweatpants strongly suggests that there was no penile vaginal rape. They were only like a few inches pulled down from her waist. In these rapes, the victim's pants are almost always completely removed, and that was not the case here, even though that's what Chris's confession said.
Yeah, and then the police also made a big deal in their investigation about some marks on Angie's left wrist. They alleged that the marks had been caused by someone holding Angie's arms down by her wrists, but there were no corresponding marks on her right wrist. And there is significant evidence to show that the marks on the left wrist were not caused by someone restraining her. The left wrist marks are described as small in a chain-like pattern, and the watch worn by Angie had an identical pattern.
The area where the clasp was could look like a thumb mark pressed on the skin. But once you look at the watch, it's just a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It wasn't on her wrist when her body was found, but the Idaho Falls Police Department also made no record of where the watch was found in the crime scene. So that's a big one to overlook as well. The disorganized sexual killer acts under impulse and usually targets someone living in the same area. And the killer acts to depersonalize his victim. So this explains the overkill in the case. There's no penis penetration by this type of offender. And another important aspect is that the disorganized sexual killer acts alone. In a group is really unheard of.
Yes. Neither Chris Tapp nor Ben Hobbs fit this profile. Chris didn't know where Angie lived because he allegedly drove to Angie's house with directions. He is of average intelligence, and he had a lot of friends. But there were several men living in Angie's neighborhood, one of which could even see into her bedroom window from his own bedroom. These men had not been confirmed to have been tested for DNA to find a match to the semen left on Angie at the scene.
That, to me, just seems like a really big thing to overlook. Why wouldn't you try and test everyone in the neighborhood, especially men that meet that profile? So just a little bit I'd like to talk about Ben Hobbs' crime in Ely, Nevada, which really set off the investigation into Chris and Ben. The only two common factors in the Nevada rape and Angie's sexually motivated murder was the use of a knife in a sexual assault. The rape in Nevada committed by Ben Hobbs was violent, and of course it was horrible, but the knife was used to threaten the victim, and she wasn't cut or killed with it. Also, Hobbs knew this woman, and he completed the sex act with penis penetration. And Hobbs showed remorse for that rape, and he didn't run away for it. He admitted to it. So Hobbs' crime certainly made him a logical suspect in the beginning to investigate, but it certainly didn't merit tunnel vision and the end to following up on other leads in Angie's murder, which were completely neglected.
Yeah, as the MO differences in the two cases became clear, the Idaho Falls Police Department should have started looking at other suspects. And when the DNA did not match either Chris or Ben, the theory of Angie being murdered by Chris and or Ben should have been set aside. But the detectives chose a hunch over actual physical evidence.
But you know, they really didn't go after Ben Hobbs. And how did they explain that?
Yeah, why is that?
I don't know. It seems very suspicious that they didn't do that. Ben had an attorney who was protecting him. And that's the only reason I could see why they let that go and concentrated on poor Chris.
Yeah, because it seems like they're pretty convinced that Chris and Hobbs acted together with a third person.
Well, because someone left that DNA and it wasn't Chris or Ben.
But they didn't charge Ben.
No. One invaluable tool in a homicide investigation is using what is called sole source information. What this is it's unique information that would only be known by the perpetrator. And this is what judges for justice call culpable knowledge. So this type of information can really establish or eliminate the possibility of actual guilt. And that's especially true in the case of a false confession. The more people who know confidential details of the crime, the less the information can be considered culpable knowledge, because it's out there. And in Angie's murder, detailed information on the crime scene leaked from the police actually within minutes of her body being discovered. Angie's landlord was told by the police that Angie had her throat cut, and this knowledge was later used as proof that Chris knew something that only the killer could have known, but that's just not true at all. If you watch the recordings of Chris's interrogations, you see detectives providing details of the crime scene to Chris. Then, when Chris repeated these details back to the detectives, they would note that they came from Chris's memory, almost like they were finding repressed memories.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. I mean, the more information they leaked to him, the more they seemed to become convinced that he was guilty. In the murder investigation, motivated and even well-intentioned Idaho Falls detectives provided extensive crime scene details to Chris.
Yeah, in his interrogation, the detectives repeatedly tried to convince him that he had been a witness to Angie's murder, and this, as he repeatedly told them, he had no memory of it. And it wasn't just Furman doing this. Detectives told Chris that he was subconsciously blocking out the memories. Now, investigators are allowed to lie to suspects, but deception shouldn't be used to provoke a false confession. By creating facts, however, detectives induced Chris to claim that Ben Hobbs had taken a framed photo from Angie's room as a souvenir, and this photo was supposedly of Angie with Hobbs' estranged wife, Deanne Calloway. But when Deanne was interviewed, she said that she had never had her picture taken with Angie. They weren't close friends.
And this is just ridiculous. The allegation that the detectives believed was that Angie had only one framed photo in her room, and it wasn't of her family or a boyfriend or a close friend, but of this woman she didn't know well enough to even be photographed with?
It's a tough one to swallow.
Such a stretch.
Yeah. Then in an effort to explain the slash on Angie's breasts, detectives came up with several different theories before finally landing on the story that Ben Hobbs made Chris slash the breast in order to be a participant who would not report Hobbs to the police. So this idea that Chris would hold down a woman to help two other men rape and kill her just isn't believable.
No, these theories really should have raised some concerns, right? What about when they went to the prosecutor? The prosecutor didn't question any of this? I would hold the prosecutor just as responsible as the investigators themselves.
Well, they pushed for it going to trial.
Absolutely. Without charging the one who supposedly left the DNA or actually killed her.
Yeah. On Dateline in 2012, Detective Kevin Brown of the Idaho Falls Police Department said that Chris knew minute details about the crime scene. This is a totally made-up story. Chris never provided any information that had not been fed to him by the detectives. He tried.
Well, that's a sad thing. He really tried to please them.
Yeah, but he was consistently incorrect and afterwards corrected by the detectives. He incorrectly identified the color of the clothing worn by Angie. He didn't correctly identify the position of her body and her clothing. For example, Chris said that Angie's pants were half off one leg and completely off the other leg. But the sweatpants were fully on both legs and pulled down only a few inches below her pubic area. Chris also never was able to say how many times Angie had been stabbed. Now, according to her autopsy report, she had approximately 16 knife wounds inflicted on her. But Chris, at different times, said that she had been stabbed 1, 2, 3 times. In fact, transcripts and video recordings of Chris's interrogations show that not one detail of the story detectives got from Chris could be verified as true or culpable knowledge.
Yeah, this is just fascinating. There were 21 alleged culpable knowledge facts known by Chris. Of these, 17 had been told to him directly. 3 were not true at all. 7 had been published in the Idaho Falls Post Register 6 months before he was interrogated. 4 were really just common knowledge to the entire community of Idaho Falls, because this was a big case. And not once was Chris the first person to mention a specific detail of this crime. So this leaves no evidence to suggest that Chris had a single detail of culpable knowledge about the MO of the killer or the crime scene. It's really remarkable if you think about it.
It certainly is.
These methods that detectives used to coach Chris into a confession were really disturbing and quite obvious, right?
That they were. The one really effective technique that was used was to repeatedly ask him the same question until he gave the answer that they wanted. And they verbally and non-verbally let him know if his answer was right or wrong as he continued to make guesses.
There was really a lot of guessing. When Chris gave incorrect information, the detectives corrected him and then had him restate his answers until they were satisfied. Another was they signaled him to change his answers simply by staring at him when he gave the wrong information and then offering praise when he told them what they wanted to hear.
And another big problem with the investigation is that there had been no effort by the police department or the medical examiner to determine the time of death. So this allowed investigators to put the time of death at whatever time they wanted, whatever best fit their theories. So they placed the time of Angie's death somewhere between 12:45 a.m. and 6:30 a.m. But the coroner who went to the crime scene did not get a body temperature to help establish a narrower time of death, and her body was taken to the office of the medical examiner and refrigerated immediately. So that destroyed any chance to determine the time of the attack by temperature. But even in the absence of body temperature, other evidence from the autopsy could have been used to help with the time of death. And if this had been done, it's possible that this evidence would have determined that Chris could not have participated in the murder. He was with a roommate from at least 3 in the morning onward on June 13th. Autopsy findings had been reviewed and strongly indicate that Angie died no earlier than 4 a.m.
So which would have ruled him out.
That would have eliminated him.
Yeah.
He's got an alibi.
Yeah, so there was some stuff about the bladder. And since you're a doctor, I'm going to have you talk about that. Because it seems like fairly solid science here.
Well, it is. According to the pathologist, her bladder had 300 mLs of urine in it. So that's about 10 ounces. That's a full bladder. Now, a person on average has an urge to urinate at around 190 mLs. So with this volume in her bladder, it's likely that she had been asleep when she was attacked. During sleep, urine production continues, but the parasympathetic nervous system relaxes the bladder and reduces the urge to urinate, which allows people to sleep for several hours and wake up with a full bladder. So you can make urine at a rate of half an ml to 1 1/4 mLs per minute. If you're drinking alcohol, the urine production can increase to 7 to 12 mLs. But you can look at that and figure out, based on how much urine was in there, that the time of death would have been at a time when Chris couldn't have done it, when he had an alibi.
Yeah. Also, that really goes to the fact that someone came in and just pounced on her when she was asleep.
Right.
Yeah.
That's when the attack started.
Right, right.
We did an experiment. I did an experiment, not on purpose. It was just one of those things when I was doing my residency.
Uh-huh.
And we were watching some baseball game and drinking beer. And, you know, we're all scientists, so we were trying to determine how much urine a bladder could hold.
So this is what geeky guys do.
Sort of. So we would drink beer, and the goal was to hold your urine as long as you could before you couldn't hold it anymore. Not entirely scientific, but close enough. And what I found, I could fill a beer bottle and a half. Or what's that, 12, 16 ounces.
So why were you putting the urine in beer bottles?
We were outside and we didn't have access to a facility.
Okay. Well, but doesn't it seem as you get older, you can't hold it as long?
For me, it is.
Well, I'm just thinking kids can sleep for 12, 14 hours. I can never sleep that long. I have to get up.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's significant. And there are also issues with the murder weapon itself. Chris repeatedly described the murder weapon as a folding pocket knife, also, you know, known as a jackknife. Detective Brown referred to the knife as a folding knife as well. And this type of knife was even shown to Chris Tapp by Detective Brown. But autopsy findings ruled out this type of knife. All of the clearly defined stab wounds on Angie are described by the pathologist as pointed at both ends. So this means that the murder weapon was a double-edged knife, like a dagger or a butterfly knife. Pocket or jackknives unfold from a single handle, and that handle protects the user from the one sharp edge. But double-edged knives are either sheathed or they're just out the front. And the out-the-front knives are those spring-loaded stilettos, switchblades.
Switchblades, yeah.
And they're illegal. Butterfly knives are also double-edged, and they're illegal because they're really difficult to unfold without injuring yourself. One of the most questionable theories that led to Chris Tapp's conviction is that multiple attacker theory, because there was really no evidence to support that. And this theory shows just a basic misunderstanding of the crime scene. There were no signs of a fight in her apartment, even in the bedroom. The evidence was just limited to this small area around her body. According to the review done by Judges for Justice, there was no physical fight. The crime is better described as a knife attack against an unarmed, sleeping woman. So the fact that Angie was a large person didn't become a factor. Nothing was knocked over, nothing was broken. The bedroom scene just indicates that she didn't even have a chance to struggle. The space was actually 6 by 10 feet. So if you had three guys in that room raping her and attacking her, the physical evidence would have been much different.
Well, in that small of a room, an enclosure, yeah.
Right, and maybe it takes a more experienced detective to recognize that.
Now, in the Idaho Falls detective's version, Angie was stabbed repeatedly before Benjamin Hobbs got any help from the other two suspects. She should have had substantial defensive wounds, because if three men had been fighting with her, they should have had wounds as well. And a fight with three men would leave behind hairs, skin cells, blood, and fingerprints from all three, not just from one of them.
Yeah, there was never any claim that gloves were worn or anything like that.
Nope. Watching the interrogation tapes, some of the most disturbing stuff happens with the multiple polygraphs given to Chris Tapp. Chris was convinced that the polygraph was a truth machine, and he didn't understand that the examiner was legally allowed to lie to him about his results. So this led to Chris questioning his own memory and believing that the polygraph knew more than even he did about his actions.
Yeah, like I said, that's just sad to watch. In Detective Stephen Finn's polygraphs, his accuracy rate for the Angie Dodge case was about 55%. And this is way below professional standards, so his conclusions were just inaccurate. In one chart that classified Chris's answers as inconclusive, Finn told Chris that he was 100% truthful. So Chris thought, well, I guess I don't remember correctly.
So he had at least 12 polygraphs administered by Finn. And he was judged to be deceptive in almost all of them. Other suspects who were never charged in the case were also deemed to be deceptive. And there were examinations of 7 men that indicated their involvement in Angie's murder.
Well, that's if you listen to Detective Finn.
Now, going through the reports, many questions asked were confusing or compound questions. And compound questions should never be used because the answer could be judged incorrectly.
Well, yeah, that's like when you put two questions into one.
Right.
You know, did you rape Angie and did you kill her? That's not a good question to ask.
No.
In the final analysis by Judges for Justice, the actions of the Idaho Falls Police Department detectives were egregious. Even if they started out as well-intentioned, they definitely abandoned basic investigative cautions and decided to follow their hunches instead of the evidence. And this failure resulted in the incarceration of an innocent man for 20 years. Also, the continued freedom of a sexually motivated killer.
In 2014, Idaho Falls Police got a subpoena to compare the DNA from their murder to a public genealogy database owned by Ancestry.com. And the results showed that the DNA had similarities with a man who lived in Louisiana, and the killer was likely to be related to him.
Well, he kind of had to be. You couldn't just likely be related. They share enough DNA to know that they are related, but perhaps distantly.
Right.
Police traveled to Louisiana and met this man, Michael P. Usry Sr., and his son, Michael Usry Jr., became a person of interest to the police. He had actually visited Idaho Falls once at the time of Angie's killing, and they found out that he's a filmmaker, and he made this really dark film about a woman's brutal murder called Murderabilia. So police got a warrant to collect his DNA, and they found out it didn't match.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so the case went cold again.
So even though they were certain that the killer had to be related to these guys, the Usrys.
Yeah. Was someone distantly related. It wasn't them.
No. So in 2017, Chris Tapp's case was appealed, and the rape charge was reversed, and his sentence was reduced from 30 to 20 years. So he's released. He's out. But his conviction still stood.
Yeah, which he was willing to do that because getting out of prison is a big deal.
Yeah.
But still.
He'd been there for 20 years.
Yeah. But still, I mean, he should be exonerated. It wasn't the full Monty. It was good, though. In 2018, the Idaho Falls Police Department contacted Parabon Nanolabs and genealogist Cece Moore to assist them by searching GEDmatch, a public repository for autosomal DNA. And results showed that Angie's killer was a grandson or a great-grandson of a couple named Clarence Usry and Cleo Landrum. So Cece Moore was able to identify 6 known male descendants of the couple, and they found that one of the suspects had been living in Idaho in 1996. But again, his DNA did not match. So this is getting frustrating. In 2019, Moore found a 7th suspect who did descend from the same couple, but he had been living under his stepfather's last name. He had been living in Idaho Falls in 1996, and in 2019, he lived in Caldwell, Idaho. So detectives followed this guy. His name is Brian Lee Drips. He threw a cigarette butt out of his pickup truck, and a detective was able to recover it. Really quickly, it was still burning. And testing of a DNA sample from the cigarette butt showed a complete match. Drips had lived right across the street from Angie in 1996, and he was the one who left DNA on her body. He did know Angie as an acquaintance, but they weren't friends.
Yeah, he was a 30-year-old male at the time of the murder, and an inexperienced Idaho Falls police officer had briefly questioned Drips in 1996 while he was out canvassing the neighborhood. But Drips denied knowing anything about the crime, and he was never brought in for interrogations. And then he left town.
Yeah, just 7 weeks later. So wouldn't you think, if there's a guy living across the street from her, and he leaves town less than 2 months after the murder, you might want to follow up with him?
Well, they might not have known he left. They hadn't shown any inclination to question him anymore.
You're right.
So how would they be keeping much in the way of a watch on him or other people?
Yeah, but he really met the profile.
Well, they didn't know it at the time.
Yeah. It slipped through the cracks, I guess.
Yep.
But after they got the DNA and he was finally brought into the police station in 2019, he confessed to the crime. He said he had planned on just raping Angie, but ended up killing her. So Drips will go to trial on charges of first-degree murder and rape in June of 2021. Prosecutors have filed a notice stating that they intend to seek the death penalty. His attorneys have requested that the court suppress his confession. So we'll see how that goes.
And why are they wanting it suppressed? Was not a valid confession? He hadn't been read his Miranda rights or something, or what?
Probably. But I mean, the DNA matches, so yeah, good luck with that.
That's not going to make any difference.
I don't think so. In July of last year, Chris Tapp's murder conviction was finally vacated. As far as the court is concerned, you are cleared of the charges you have been living under for the past 20-plus years, Judge Alan Stevens stated in his decision. It was believed to be the first time that genetic genealogy has been used to exonerate a defendant, so it's significant.
Yeah. Afterwards, Tapp said, "I'm so thankful that I've been given this second chance at life. I've wasted 20 years of my life for something I never did. But I also grew up a lot over these 20 years.
But boy, I hope he's getting therapy, or he has had therapy, because I don't know how you deal with that.
Oh, I don't either.
And those are his prime years, right? From 20 to 40, basically.
Yep.
Taken from him. Plus, you have to think, a lot of people thought he was guilty, which has to be difficult. His mom did stand by him, but a lot of people thought he was a killer.
Yeah, He must have thought he had fallen into the rabbit hole or something, because, geez, it's not his DNA at the scene, but he's convicted.
Well, that's just like that interview you did with Jeffrey Deskovic.
Yep.
There was DNA in that girl's vaginal cavity.
Yep.
And they just said, well, she had sex with someone else, and then he came and killed her, which is such a stretch.
Oh, I think so.
But, I mean, also they were both young guys.
Yeah.
Easy to manipulate.
Very. So this district attorney, who 2 years previously had said Chris was complicit in Dodge's death, did join in the motion to vacate the murder conviction. Then in December of 2019, Chris Tapp filed a state court lawsuit seeking damages from the city of Idaho Falls.
Well, yeah, and he should have enough money to be comfortable the rest of his life. He deserves that after losing this huge chunk of his life.
Yeah, I was thinking that probably won't ever go to court.
Really?
They'll settle.
Well, yeah. I think they pretty much have to. It's just such a clear case.
I don't see how they're going to expect to win anything if they go to court.
Right, right. So it's just fascinating. So the sources we used for this case include an investigative case review by Judges for Justice from 2014. Also, we referred to the National Registry of Exonerations. There's a special, or a limited series, called Wrong Man on Stars, and Season 1, Episodes 5 and 6 focus on this case. Dateline has had more than one episode on this case, and I have to tell you, Keith was involved in some of that, so you might want to check on that. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you enjoy our shows, would you please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen? A lot of you have already done it, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, so we're going to get into some feedback. Before doing that, let me just mention our TCB store.
Yay!
Thanksgiving's over. Looming on the horizon are Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, and Christmas. If you're looking for a gift or a stocking stuffer, check out our TCB store. T-shirts, both long-sleeved and short-sleeved, hoodies, and because we're in partnership with T Public, the prices are very reasonable and the quality is high. Please check it out.
Well, yeah, that sounds like you're trying to sell something, but I have a couple T-shirts and even a couple hoodies, and they are really nice and pretty inexpensive. Like I've said before, the lightweight hoodie is my favorite. You know how a lot of hoodies are just bulky and you get too hot? These are perfect.
Yeah, these are really nice.
They're a big hit, yeah. So that's a great thing.
Lots of different colors, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, on to feedback. I got a voicemail and a couple emails. And the voicemail's from Susie. She has two case suggestions.
All right, Susie, not messing around.
She's getting her money's worth.
Hi, Dick and Jill. This is Susie from Maryland. I have two cases that I wanted to suggest. The first one is very close to my home, from Germantown, Maryland. It is a case of the Hoggle, H-O-G-G-L-E, the Hoggle children. Catherine Hoggle is the mother. This happened in 2014. My son and I were actually part of a search party, and the children have never been found. And there's a lot of twists and turns, and it's not yet settled. So I can understand if you wouldn't want to take this because it's still a lot of things up in the air. If you do decide to broadcast that one, I would like to suggest the Waradaka Brewing Company, which is really close to my home. And keeping Jill in mind, I would say go for the Little Dam Honey Wheat IPA. It is made with honey from the bees, actually, at the farm. It's very smooth, and I think you might both enjoy it. For another one that does have a very clear ending, but it was long and drawn out, would be one from Australia. And that is Ivan Milat, M-I-L-A-T. And it is the Belangolo State Forest Murders. And for an Australian beer, I would suggest Little Creatures Pale Ale. So I know you don't like a lot of compliments, but I do very much enjoy the podcast. I enjoy your banter, and I love when you all agree to disagree. So thanks for a great podcast. I will keep listening, and hopefully maybe you will broadcast either one or both of these episodes. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks, Susie. I actually do like compliments. I just don't like to play them for people because I think other people might say, oh, brother, right? Plus, yeah, well, you know, I'm a little shy about it. Yeah.
I'm thinking, geez, they're just always praising Jill and nothing about me. So I don't want to hear them anyway. No,
okay.
Only kidding.
Okay. So we've got two case suggestions. The Hoggle Children. I've never heard of it.
Well, the interesting thing about this is that the mother, Catherine, was charged with murder. But she's been judged mentally incompetent because she's been diagnosed a paranoid schizophrenic. And they've been arguing for some time about whether her prognosis for recovery is present or not. Because if they can get her to the point where they say she is recovered, then they can charge her with murder.
Oh, okay.
But the latest thing I read is that her psychiatrists say, not going to happen. She's just doesn't have a very good prognosis.
That is just tragic. Two little kids like that.
Yeah, it is. But I don't think you're going to get closure in the sense that the person who's likely killed them is not going to ever go to trial.
Right. Well, the whole thing's tragic when you're dealing with that kind of thing.
Oh, a two-year-old and a three-year-old? Yeah.
Yeah, and their mom? I mean, really, you can't get much worse.
Nope.
Ivan Milat, I have heard of.
I think we've talked about this a little bit because I don't remember. He's known as the backpack murderer because he liked to prey on hitchhikers. He's responsible for murdering 7 people that we know of. But I remember talking about this because of the Bellagio Forest or whatever. That rang a bell. But I think we've looked at this before. Anyway, we haven't done an episode, so.
Yeah, I think that one we could totally do. I've been looking for some more Australian ones because we do enjoy those. We get a lot of recommendations for them.
We do. So thank you, Susie.
Thank you very much, Susie, and we'll try that beer, too.
Absolutely.
So we have an email with a case suggestion from Summer. Summer writes, I'd like to suggest an episode on Wendy Andriano. She poisoned her husband while he was dying of cancer. When the poison didn't work, she bludgeoned him with the leg of a chair and stabbed him. So this happened in Arizona and was prosecuted by Juan Martinez. She did receive the death penalty. There's a great episode of Snapped about her. It's a really interesting case, and the defense she put up at her trial was strange, to say the least. I think you and your listeners would really enjoy this case, especially since it involves Juan Martinez. And yes, she took the stand and was cross-examined about her crazy story. I love your podcast. Thank you for taking the time to thoroughly research every episode. So Juan Martinez, he was the Casey Anthony prosecutor.
Right.
We saw him at CrimeCon.
We did.
And also read his book. He's an interesting guy.
Yes, he is. Now, she was convicted of murdering her terminally ill husband in 2000. Her claim was that she was an abused spouse, and she killed her husband in self-defense. This guy was on chemo. He had actually initially tried holistic therapy, and his cancer, for some reason or other, didn't get any better on the holistic therapy.
Shocking.
So he turned to chemo, but he was pretty wasted and weakened. There's absolutely no way he could be an abusive spouse.
So she just wasn't very patient.
Nope.
Okay.
In a hurry.
I guess so. Must have been money or something at the heart of it. Or just anger. We'll watch the Snapped episode, Summer. Because Snapped is usually fun.
Yes, yeah. It is.
Thank you so much. And next is a case suggestion from Megan.
Yeah. Megan says, I don't drink. However, I love this podcast. Well, that's okay. You don't have to drink to love the podcast.
No, we're not trying to push people to drink.
Or you could be an alcoholic and love the podcast.
Absolutely. I mean, could be anybody.
She says, I know it's been done lots of times, but I'd be interested to hear your perspective and views on the West Memphis 3. I thought you both covered the satanic panic thing well in Dungeons & Dragons Murder, and it really got me curious about what your thoughts are on the West Memphis 3. I imagine you get loads of requests, but I just wanted to mention this. At the very least, just send you some positive feedback. Megan.
Thank you, Megan. So, yeah, of course we're familiar with that case. Just about everybody is. And it's one of those cases I would like to cover at some point, but I always feel like if it has that much coverage, what are we really going to be able to add to it other than our opinions, which you have to take with a grain of salt or two.
Or two grains. Oh, no, you said two grains.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's correct. We have it on your little whiteboard over there.
Is that on our list?
It's been there for about 2 years.
So, yeah, we have a long list, though, in fairness.
I suppose at some point we are going to do it because it was a fascinating case.
Yes. I think it's the kind of case I'd like to do after having a week off so I can devote more time to it. But then it really wouldn't be a week off, would it? It'd just be an extra week of researching. Yeah, which is okay. But good recommendation, Megan. I'm sure it's been recommended before. There have been probably a handful of cases we've talked about that had something to do with the satanic panic. In some cases, there was a satanic aspect to it, but in most, not really.
You know, I'm just thinking, when you're talking about Juan Martinez, I think he prosecuted the Jodi Arias case, not...
Oh, you're right.
Not Anthony.
You are right. Yes, it was Jodi. Because everybody was asking him all these questions. People are just fascinated by her.
Yeah. Just so we don't get too many letters from people saying, you stupid bastards, don't you know who it was?
Oh, people probably were pulling their hair out. Good thing you corrected it. So they don't have to go to sleep being enraged.
I know.
Right? Yeah, the guy who prosecuted Casey Anthony, he was interesting too, though. We did read a book by him. This was years ago because we covered this case probably in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, fascinating. Well, thank you everyone for your feedback and for taking time out of your lives to listen to us banter back and forth.
We certainly appreciate it.
We do. We do. And we will see you next time at the Quiet End.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.